getting up to speed this hour on developments in Washington. Our attention was directed to Alexandria, Virginia yesterday morning, and a gunman who wounded five people, including Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana. We're learning more about this and other news around our nation's capital with Celeste Lay. She's an associate professor of political science at Tulane University in New Orleans. Her areas of expertise include American political behavior, political socialization, and public policy. Celeste, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, what was your reaction when we learned about the shooting yesterday?
Oh, I think like everyone else, it's scary and shocking, disappointing, of course.
Well, part of the reason, we reached out to you is because you're in New Orleans, which is the area where Congressman Steve Scalise is a representative. He's the House Majority Whip, which makes him the third-ranking Republican in the caucus. Let's talk a little bit about how big a player he is in GOP politics.
Well, he is sort of a rising star and a very quickly rising star. He was elected to the U.S. House in 2008, and so that's a pretty quick trajectory from first being elected to becoming the third-ranking leader in the House of Representatives. So he's very well-liked in his district here. He has a sort of a sliver of New Orleans, but the majority of his district is the suburbs around New Orleans, and he worked in the State House here for several years before moving on to the House of Representatives.
How have people in your area been reacting to this news that he was shot?
Well, everyone is, of course, very concerned, and our mayor here, Mitch Landrieu, and Congressman Scalise have their political differences, to be sure. But he has, he put out a statement either last night or early this morning, calling for the city to pray for Steve Scalise. I was looking for updates on his condition this morning. It doesn't seem like there's been much of an update other than he's still in very critical condition. So I think everyone is sending out their best thoughts and prayers and hopes that he makes a full and quick recovery.
Well, House Speaker Paul Ryan gave a speech on the House floor in which he basically said that while members of Congress have their differences, quote, we do not shed our humanity when we enter the chamber. Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi also gave a speech encouraging everyone to do their best in today's charity baseball game and that we'll use the occasion to be unified instead of divided. It is a change. It's a shift. How long can we expect this moment of unity, perhaps, or reaching across the aisle to last?
Well, call me cynical, but I don't think it's going to last very long. This is not the first time that we've seen, a congressperson get shot. You know, Congresswoman Cammie Giffords was shot several years ago in her district and very seriously wounded. And that we saw similar calls after the fact. I believe right after she was shot, the State of the Union occurred a couple of weeks later, and Republicans and Democrats didn't do what they normally do, which is to each take a side of the chamber and all sit together. They sort of intermingled and sat, with one another. But that did not last very long, and I don't anticipate that this will change much in the long term. But any sort of reprieve, I suppose, from sort of the toxic atmosphere that we have been in for the last several years is welcome, I think.
There also has been some talk of perhaps tamping down the criticism of President Trump, not only by politicians, by Americans themselves.
Yeah.
What do you make of that behavior?
Well, I think it's all of these are very good sentiments. You know, I think both sides would do well to take a breath and to focus more on the substance of what's happening politically, the policies, the Health Care Act, for example, rather than attacking the individuals. I think it's much easier in our media environment today to attack people very quickly and anonymously through social media and other electronic means of communication. And so, you know, if I don't disagree that it would be good to take, you know, to bring down that rhetoric against President Trump, I think it would also be useful for the other side to do the same thing with whether it's, you know, talk show hosts or regular Americans on the other side, to also tamp down their, particularly the personal rhetoric that attacks people personally and advocates violence. There is an interesting study by a researcher at Louisiana State University by the name of Nathan Calmo, who did several experiments looking at how rhetoric, particularly the use of terms like war, battle, the fighting, these sorts of terms, as juxtaposed to contest, race, that sort of thing, it does actually increase support for anti-government tendencies. And so it does matter, the kinds of words that people use and the rhetoric around how people talk about others makes a difference. And so there are, on both sides, a minority of individuals that have violent tendencies and are unstable. And, you know, to the extent that that kind of rhetoric encourages that sort of antisocial behavior, it would be good on both sides, I think, to tamp down that rhetoric.
We're talking right now with Tulane University political scientist Celeste Lay about the latest developments around Capitol Hill. Of course, we're paying attention to the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia yesterday that wounded U.S. Congressman Steve Scalise, who represents a district that includes a sliver of New Orleans suburbs and bayou parishes. And we have David here on Facebook who says our current president spent a year overtly inciting violence. Regardless of where it's coming from now, we as a nation need to have a moment to reflect on what we've now become and decide whether or not reestablishing the rule of law starts at the top or not. Celeste, what would you think about what David has to say?
Well, I think he's absolutely right in terms of the rhetoric in the 2016 campaign, particularly in terms of advocating violence with regard to Trump. And, you know, it's difficult, I think, when the president himself continues that rhetoric. He certainly, as president, is not openly calling for violence in the same way that there was during the campaign. But, you know, he was up tweeting this morning, in fact, not about the shooting, but about the investigation into ties with Russia and his campaign and, you know, attacking those who are doing the investigating. And so it's very hard. I think, you know, the person on Facebook is right. Does this begin at the top? Do we have to have a president that is setting the appropriate tone? Or can people do this from the grassroots? Can they themselves make a change in their media consumption habits and the way they speak on social media and to one another and without that cue from our leadership? I think it's much harder without the appropriate cues.
Let's take a call now. Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I've been, you know, thinking about this for a number of years. You know, to me it started, and I'm sure it predated this, but to me it started with the, you know, the whole war on women junk, that because you might believe life begins at conception or that you believe that people should be responsible for the only elective medicines, that suddenly you have a war on women, or the Black Lives Matter movement, which kind of insinuates that white people don't believe Black Lives Matter. I just think that rhetoric is absolutely poisonous. You could have a debate and not say the other person who disagrees with you is evil. So I 100% agree with your guest.
Celeste?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the war on women and any sort of war rhetoric tends to be a spark for people in the fringes. And, you know, it is possible to attack another person's policies and positions on issues without directly attacking that person, without without making it a personal complaint or a personal attack. And both sides would be, you know, would be better off, I think, if we stopped doing that.
Well, a congressman from Georgia, Republican Barry Loudermilk, said after the shooting that members of Congress who have a concealed carry permit from their home state ought to be able to carry a weapon in Washington as well. With the Republicans in control of both houses in the presidency, do you see any traction on something like this happening?
I do. I think, you know, we have, like you said, a Republican House, a Republican Senate, a Republican President, all of which are heavily endorsed by the National Rifle Association and other gun rights groups. That's a big part of their constituency and their base. And there is a strong belief. I mean, this is one of the big cleavages between, I think, the two parties is that, you know, on one side, there's people that believe that the more armed people we have out there, the safer we're likely to be. And there, on the other side, is the exact opposite belief that more guns in the environment makes us less safe. I think we don't have as much quality research on this topic as we should, in part because Congress back in the 90s placed limits on public health researchers. They can't conduct that kind of research to be able to empirically determine whether or not more guns makes us safer. Some of the evidence coming out in just the last year or so would indicate that that's not the case, that in fact more guns does make us less safe, but that remains a solid belief among a very significant and powerful portion of the Republican base. And with Republican control of the federal government, I would not be surprised at all if we see an expansion of the kinds of gun laws that we have seen at the state level. Many states have expanded those, open carry and permitless carry and these kinds of laws, and I would not be surprised to see those kinds of laws at the federal level either.
Let's go to John now in Rib Lake. Hi, John.
Good morning. Yesterday, after the shooting and all the coverage, especially on CNN, there was a particular congressperson who was being interviewed, you know, commenting on what was all going on. And that person said, up until that day, yesterday, he never felt unsafe, but now that all changed. And I compare that feeling of unsafe or insecurity. Now that particular congressman knows how we the people feel with the way Congress, wielding all the power they have with the Republican majority, attacking things that we the people feel are our safeties, i.e., health care, that sort of thing. I wish they would just think about that, how ordinary folks are so unsure and insecure when we seem to be assaulted.
Oh, Celeste.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting analogy. I think I heard that congressperson, I can't remember what his name was, but he said something like, I don't think I will ever feel completely safe at a baseball field again. And what I thought of was how young children must feel whenever their schools have been involved in a school shooting. There was I don't know if it was the Washington Post, but there was a recent article that looked at some kids 8 months after a school shooting in South Carolina and the long-term effects on those that survive. There's typically a lot of focus in the immediate aftermath, as there should be, on those who were killed. But this article talked about the fact that 8 months, a year later, you know, these kids are still often afraid to go to school and have serious psychological issues. And you know, there's not a lot of attention on that kind of thing. And my hope in listening to that congressperson yesterday was maybe there will be a little bit more empathy, whether it be in terms of the kinds of policies directed at schools and the services that they provide to students, but just a lot more understanding and empathy, I think, towards, if this is a sort of a grown man saying this, who has in a position of power and authority, what that must feel like for, you know, a 5 or 6 year old whose school has, you know, has been involved in a shooting.
And certainly we did hear some congressmen reacting to security issues of their own in their personal life. Some said they will go about their business as usual. Another said he was telling his staffers to use the tunnels around the Capitol. You know, how might this security issue play out for these lawmakers holding town halls in their districts?
Well, you know, Steve Scalise actually has not held a town hall, I believe, this entire calendar year. There have been calls here for him to hold a town hall, but I don't believe he's held an open forum. And I would not be surprised if this incident leads other members of Congress, particularly Republicans who are sort of in the hot seat because they control both the House and the Senate and the White House right now, to use this as a reason. Maybe legitimately, but even so, to make it more difficult for their constituents to reach them in an open forum like a town hall.
Well, Kenneth in Janesville has a quick question. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. Haven't we crossed in this historical red line in that these people were the first people attempted to be killed for being Republicans or Democrats in this country?
Celeste?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a red line. I mean, I think, like I said before with Congresswoman Giffords, you know, whether she was shot because she was a Democrat, I'm not sure, but she was certainly shot because she was a member of Congress. And, you know, we've seen white supremacists shoot up African-American churches in Charleston, South Carolina. We've seen another white supremacist in Portland stab a couple of people on a train a couple of weeks ago. You know, in terms of when we cross a line, it all depends on where you sit. Many people would argue that we crossed the line a long time ago, and that things have just escalated ever since that time.
We're talking with Tulane University political scientist Celeste Lay about the latest developments around Capitol Hill. Of course, paying close attention to the shooting in Alexandria, Virginia yesterday that wounded Congressman Steve Scalise, who represents a district that includes a little bit of New Orleans. We'll be moving on to talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions' testimony on the Russia probe this week and where senators stand on writing an Obamacare overhaul. You can join in this discussion. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. That's coming up right after these news headlines from NPR and WPR. Attorney General Jeff Sessions tried to clear his name in the Russia election meddling investigation in heated testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee Tuesday.
And the suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process is an appalling and detestable lie.
We're looking at the takeaways from his testimony now with Celeste Lay. She's an associate professor of political science at Tulane University in New Orleans. Celeste, what were your big takeaways from the Sessions testimony this week?
Well, one of them was that I can't seem to keep up with everything that's going on. you know, last week was the Comey hearings, and this week was, you know, Sessions, and now the shooting and everything else.
And you're supposed to have work to do.
I know. It's a full-time job just to follow the news, and then I also have a lot of other responsibilities, too, in the rest of my life. But in terms of Jeff Sessions, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway was how many of his answers involved him being unable to remember things and being a lack of confidence in his memory. And, you know, when I watch a lot of the people that have been around Trump for, you know, during his campaign and who are part of, you know, the upper parts of his administration, I'm reminded of Hanlon's razor, which essentially states, never attribute to malice that which is inadequately explained by stupidity. And I just, as I'm watching this, I can't tell as a citizen, this is as a citizen, not a political scientist, you know, but, you know, whether there is a lack of memory, and, you know, whether it's silly tweets on the part of the president or Sessions lacks memory, if that's because there's something that they're covering up or simply because they don't really know what they're doing. I'm not sure. And of course, you know, Trump has already tweeted this morning that this is all the single greatest witch hunt in American political history. So it's, we have a long way to go, I think, in this investigation.
Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon told Sessions that Americans are tired of stonewalling and that they want answers. And Sessions insisted he was not stonewalling, that he's, quote, following the historic policies of the Department of Justice on private talks with the White House. How bothered do you think people are with officials like Sessions, with James Comey and the national intelligence top leaders for holding back? Or do you think people are understanding of that excuse?
Well, I think it depends on who we're talking about. I mean, I think Comey was fairly forthcoming in his testimony. Whatever you may think of James Comey and his behavior with the email issue last year or the Trump investigation, he was fairly forthcoming, with the exception of details about the specifics of the investigation. And he had already been out of the investigation for a number of weeks by the time he testified. So, for instance, he didn't know that Mueller has begun to look at President Trump, because that did not happen until after Comey was fired. It's just difficult, I think, for the average American to know these sort of just these terms of executive privilege. What does that exactly mean? And who invokes executive privilege? Does the person who's speaking to the president invoke it, or does the president himself invoke executive privilege? And what can be spoken about in a public session of Congress? And unfortunately, in our sort of hyper-partisan atmosphere, people's opinions about this depend almost entirely on where they sit. If they voted for Donald Trump, in many cases, they agree with him that there's nothing to see here and that this is a witch hunt. If they did not vote for Donald Trump, then they see this as sort of democracy in action. So it's a very partisan situation.
Atmosphere, yeah. And that we should perhaps pursue law degrees to referee America's politics.
Yeah, I mean, we're depending on lawyers, and, you know, there's a lot of lawyer jokes for a reason. So
how likely is it, Celeste, that we'll arrive at some conclusion to this Russia investigation, this probe?
Well, we certainly will someday. It just depends on how long this will take. The independent counsel, with President Clinton, for example, investigated for a number of years before there were ever, you know, ever impeachment articles, for example. And so I think at this point, at least from the public's perspective, we don't know a whole lot. There's a lot of smoke. You know, there's a lot of, in terms of leaks to reporters, and, you know, there's a lot of innuendo, and we simply just don't know where it's all going to go. But I think that's the point of Robert Mueller, is to get to the bottom of the smoke and see if there's any fire there. And, it's interesting to me that when Bob Mueller was first appointed to this position, people on both sides of the aisle were very positive about him, and, you know, believed that he was going to be very fair and that this was a great choice. And now we're starting to see Republicans like Newt Gingrich and others really put pressure on Mueller in terms of calling him a partisan and placing some suspicion on the investigation. And I don't think that's helpful for the American people. We already have a situation where we tend to live in alternate realities in terms of what you believe depends almost entirely on what your source of information is. If you're watching Fox News, or if you're watching MSNBC, if you're reading the New York Times, or you know, if you're reading the Washington Times, or you know, the Wall Street Journal, and so you know, we need some person or some institution that all of us can agree is, you know, if not objective, then is at least not openly biased. And it's really disheartening to see some of the same people that praise Bob Mueller now come out and talk about him as if he is just another partisan hack that's out to get the president.
Let's take a call on this. Bob in Hurley. Hi, Bob. What would you like to add?
Good morning.
Good morning. As I listened to sessions, I think that, you know, this was a man that's trying to stave off criticisms. And I believe that actually a lot of the criticisms that we've heard about since the election are unfounded. I believe that there are some in the Democratic Party that believe that it's good. I believe, however, in the long run, it's hurting the party. I also believe that there's an elephant in the room. And the actions yesterday with the shooting, with Sanders coming out and vehemently speaking against violence, the elephant in the room is, you know, the primary process of the Democrats and how this election was really stolen from Bernie Sanders. Excuse me.
Well, Celeste, a lot to unpack there. The elephant in the room, that the election was stolen by Bernie Sanders.
Stolen from Bernie.
I'm sorry, from Bernie.
I think there's been a lot of evidence that is not necessarily the case in terms of, you know, the votes and public opinion during the Democratic primary, in terms of you know, the much of that is often based on complaints about the DNC, for example, the Democratic National Committee being on the side of Hillary Clinton, and the evidence for that is fairly shaky, and this is, you know, There is plenty to complain about in terms of the primary process, the length of the election, and, you know, whether there are the rules on both sides are fair and whether they give advantages to the right kinds of candidates. This is something that both parties have been dealing with since the 70s, when the presidential primary system was originally put in place, and continues to be reformed every 4 years on the basis of what happened in the last election. And so it really remains to be seen over the course of the next year or so what the Democratic Party does in terms of reforming its primary rules before the next presidential election.
And before we let you go here, we want to get your quick take here on health care. In a meeting with Senate Republicans, President Trump reportedly called the House health care bill, quote, mean, and said it should be more generous. This is the same bill he called a great plan the very day the House passed it. Any idea what's going on there?
Well, I'm not sure that the president really knows exactly what's in the bill, and I say that not as some sort of slam against the president. I don't think any of us really know what's in the bill. The Republicans in the Senate are not doing this in regular order, which means this is just really not how the system is supposed to work. There have been no hearings. There may be no hearings before the Senate decides to vote. There is no score from the Congressional Budget Office. This is, you know, the office that looks at proposed legislation and determines estimates of how much it's going to cost and whether it's budget neutral and how many people in the case of health care may gain or lose health care. We have no idea about that score or anything, because everything is taking place in secret. Everything is taking place behind closed doors. And I believe it was a Republican staffer the other day was asked by a reporter, why are you doing it this way? And his response was, because we're not stupid. which, you know, indicates that they know that this is an unpopular bill. There was a piece in the New York Times yesterday by a couple of social scientists that estimated support within the states of the AHCA, the House bill anyway. And there is not a single state in which a majority of people say they support the AHCA. And so, you know, this there's just a lot of unknowns. And so, you know, Trump is, when that sort of "it's a mean bill" statement is likely going on what he reads, and, you know, and what is sort of the atmosphere around this. But in terms of specifics of the legislation, we just don't know. And that's really unusual, particularly of a bill of this size and it's going to have this much effect on the American public.
Well, Celeste, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Celeste Lay is an associate professor of political science at Tulane University in New Orleans. Her areas of expertise include American political behavior. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Nyasia Ellison. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and you're listening to The Joy Cardine Show here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us.